There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Outdoor Edge in their complete lineup of knives and game processing kits. These guys right now are doing an absolutely huge giveaway where you could win an elk hunt, and not just any elk hunt. We're talking about a 7 or 8 mile horseback ride into the backcountry. We're talking a one-on-one guided hunt. You're going to be sleeping in a wall tent, and you're going to be doing that for 5 days with the founder and CEO of Outdoor Edge, David Block. Now, if you've never been on an elk hunt before, I'm telling you right now, go sign up for this, because if you ever hear a elk bugle, whether it's at 400 yards or it's at 40 yards, it is a life-changing experience. So here's how you enter. Go to OutdoorEdge.com. There's going to be a big banner for it somewhere on their homepage. All you have to do is click on that. Go fill out some information. I think your name, your email address, maybe some other stuff. And that's all you have to do. That's how you are entered. They're going to be picking a winner, a ways from now. So you have plenty of time to enter. Go visit OutdoorEdge.com. Sign up today. Here we go.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and I'm the host of the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I'll also be your host into the world of hunting, the icon of North American wilderness, the bear. We'll talk about tactics, gear, conservation, but we'll also bring you into some of the wildest country on the planet, chasing bear. I always enjoy interviewing the professionals, the people that have dedicated their lives to the subject at hand. The subject today is bears, black bears in Oklahoma. And Sarah Lida is a biologist, and she's dedicated the last 20 years of her life to black bears in Oklahoma. And She was the first person to actually do research on bears in the early 2000s. So Sarah is a great guest, extremely knowledgeable, and she was hard to get on the podcast. It was easier to get Ted Nugent and Steve Rinella. So you're going to enjoy Sarah Lida, one of my friends and a great conservationist, Sarah Lida. The Western Bear Foundation is a nonprofit hunting conservation organization standing up for the rights of bears. Yep, you heard it, bears. Conservationists and hunters like us, like the Western Bear Foundation, we love bears. We want them to be on the landscape. We want them to thrive. We want them to be, their numbers to be in balance with the habitat so that they can be strong and healthy. There's some people that don't understand that. They don't understand the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation and using hunting as a tool. Our buddies at the Western Bear Foundation, they understand that, and they're standing up for the rights of sportsmen and for bears out west. They're a nonprofit organization. You can join their organization, and you'll get some great perks. Your voice will be in the fight for bears. Check them out. So we just came out with a really cool hat. It's a First Light Fusion camo pattern. Actually, First Light hat. It has a First Light logo on the side. But we put our famous, now famous, bear grease patch on the front of it. We're selling that hat. We sold so many that we sold out what we had in hand. And so now we're taking back orders. Some of the guys that ordered, those hats are on back order. We should have them relatively quick, and we'll be sending them out. But check out that hat. And we just came out with a new mule riding bear hunter shirt. You're going to want to check that out at bear-hunting.com. Check out all our merch. And also, Bear Hunting Magazine, man. We're the only print bear hunting magazine in the world. We dedicate our lives. Our knuckles literally bleed on the keyboard as we're building this magazine, full of tactics, gear, conservation, adventure hunting, how to cook bear, what to do with bear hides, and just the general spirit of goodwill and awesomeness for black bear hunting across North America. Did you know that black bears are the most numerous large carnivore in the world? That's correct. You heard me right. Black bears are thriving. Check out Bear Hunting Magazine. You can get a subscription for $25 a year. You spend that much money at McDonald's. I mean, if you go to McDonald's, you'll spend that much money at McDonald's. Get a subscription to Bear Hunting Magazine. Bear-hunting.com. Sarah Lida, you don't realize it, but you're a highly valued guest on the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. We've been trying to get her on here for a long time.
True story.
It's easier to get like Ted Nugent on this podcast than Sarah Lida.
It's true.
I'm hard to pin down.
we're in Southeast Oklahoma, overlooking an incredible view of the Ouachita Mountains.
Yeah.
For real.
Beautiful.
And no, Sarah, thank you for meeting with us. We tried to do this a couple other times and ran into some roadblocks. But I was just telling her that these biology podcasts always do good. Mm-hmm. People are always interested. And I think you were worried that we might be covering some of the same stuff that we talked about with all these other biologists. But I don't care what if we talk about the same things all over again. You may not have heard it. When I have any kind of awkward silence in any conversation with anybody in my life, if I'm at the grocery store, if you're my best friend, if you're my wife, we talk about the
delayed implantation.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. It's like, you know much about delayed implantation and black bears?
Guess how cool bears are.
that's my go-to conversation. But now, Sarah, tell me who you work for.
Okay, so I work for Oklahoma State University.
Okay.
I work through the Oklahoma Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit, and all of the research that we do is for the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation in an effort to aid their management schemes.
Now, this is terrible. I did this to you in 2015. I misstated the college that you work for.
Be very cautious.
I know. It's so hard with state lines. Like, I could tell you every college in Arkansas, uh-huh. Drive 10 minutes into Oklahoma, and I'm like on a different planet. You work for Oklahoma State University.
Go Cowboys.
I was about to say the Cowboys.
And where are they at? What city?
It's in Stillwater. The main campus is in Stillwater.
How big is Oklahoma State University?
I believe that they have 24,000 students or
no
so.
No way. That's
yeah,
a big college.
It's a good side school.
I didn't realize Stillwater was that big.
Mm-hmm. It's growing. It's definitely growing. Yeah. Quite frankly, it's a wonderful town. I wish Stillwater, though, was about where Poto is so that we could actually get to the mountains more easily.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it's a great little town to live in, and it's growing yeah. really fast. And it's the land grant university in the state. So campus is beautiful, very much focused on outdoor beauty and agricultural sciences and that kind of thing.
Okay. So that's who you work for. And you are you're working with research students, graduate students on projects that are always related to Bear or not always related to Bear?
Right. For the past, since 2010, I have been strictly Bear-related.
Right.
I am employed through our grants for the Bear research, and my job, although it's adjusted over those years, because when I first started back in 2010, I was the only one on the project and was actually doing the field work.
Right.
And reports and everything else. Now, as we've moved forward, as of 2014, we started actually bringing on graduate students and more technicians and that kind of thing. So
you're overseeing these projects.
I oversee all of the field aspects of the Bear research in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And so we have Dr. Sue Fairbanks, who is a professor, a tenured professor at OSU, and she is the major advisor for all of the graduate students that we have on the Bear Project, and she's technically our principal investigator. And so she handles all thing research related in terms of writing the papers and managing the students from an academic standpoint.
Okay.
And then I oversee all of the research efforts from a field standpoint.
Okay. Maybe you know this answer. Does your funding for your projects come from Pittman Robertson funds?
Absolutely.
Does it really?
It's federal. Yep. Federal. Mm-hmm. Yes. Wine. Yes. Okay. Yeah, all of the reports that we send in, they go to the ODWC, but then they also get moved on to the federal's folks so that they can see what we're doing with that money.
Can you just a lot of people would be familiar with Pittman Robertson, but can you describe that? I mean, I could do it, but I would want to hear you do it. I mean, it's an excise tax.
Right. So the money comes from all the sales of anything sportsman related, hunting and fishing related. And,
right.
And so it's our hunters, it's our conservationists that are out there that are actually paying for the work that we're doing. So that's the federal side of the match money. And then of course the ODWC and the university also have their side pitching in.
Right.
But if we didn't have that federal money to fund this, we wouldn't have a Bear
project.
So that is
like a big part, and it's become much more common knowledge inside the hunting community in the last probably even 5 years. But just this idea that the Pittman Robertson money, which is an excise tax, which means it's an additional tax on guns, ammunition, and hunting related equipment. So sportsmen choose to, by choose we mean we just hadn't voted it out and made it different. So we've made a choice that this money is going to be given to the federal government, and the federal government ear tags it for these specific things all related to conservation and wildlife. And one of those things, so I've been doing some study on it for something I'm writing, but there's these very many things that it could go to, but one of them is research. And that's why I wanted to see if this was funded by Pittman Robertson money.
Correct.
I was actually last night, in my truck, I had three people with me, none of them from the United States. They were friends of my daughter's from college,
mm-hmm.
Have no context for North American hunting, zero. And so I took them coon hunting. It's coon season in Arkansas. And that was my go-to thing to... Early on in the conversation, because they know I like to talk about this stuff, and they're like, tell us why honey is important, is essentially what they asked, almost word for word. Within 5 minutes, I was talking about the Pittman Robertson. I was like, hey, we're funding this. This is a user pay system. And I think that's important for people to know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just like we like to coon hunt. I mean, we do, but it's bigger than that. There's more to it than that, but.
we're consumptive users, but we're also giving back. I mean, that's the whole point, is that, you know, people hunt for various reasons, but it's 99.9%, if not 100% of the time, it's because we love the wildlife species that we're hunting we're out viewing and watching. And so we want to make sure that they're managed properly so we can continue that heritage.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up on a hunting plantation in South Carolina that my dad was the manager of. He was a forester and a wildlife biologist. And so, I mean, I grew up in the woods, on the water, and in the skin and shed. You know, I'd finish my riding lessons, I'd get my homework done and wait for the lights to roll in so I could go sit at the skin and shed and see what came in that night. You know, I mean, it's a way of life, and we're extremely fortunate to be able to participate in that.
Yeah.
And to know that we're giving back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to get into your current research. I want to hear some cool stories of just, I mean, you've had a lot of hands-on experience with bears, but I want to go back to you were one of the first people doing research on these Oklahoma bears.
I am the first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just to give a little bit of a context, and people have heard me talk about, you know, the reintroduction in Arkansas quite a bit, but, you know, maybe some people wouldn't be familiar. So, I mean, essentially, bears were here in Oklahoma. This is native range for them. They would have been here almost statewide, I guess. I guess parts of the panhandle they wouldn't have been, but...
Yeah.
But...
Well, they might have been out in the very western part of the panhandle because of that New Mexico and Colorado connection.
Yeah.
But probably, you know, say from I-35 west, they probably couldn't have really survived very well. So it would have been mostly the forested areas of the state.
Which would be like the eastern third of Oklahoma?
Probably.
About the eastern third, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so just in the last, let's say, 50, 60 years, bears have come back into Oklahoma. And so this population built, and then you showed up and were the first one to do actual research on these bears.
Right. So I know that Joe Hempel and Jeff Ford had been working for years before we finally got the project started that I got to work on. But in the 90s, the late 90s, they started working to try to get approval for a project because they started having more and more sightings of bears in the southeastern part of the state. And as luck would have it, a friend of mine from University of Tennessee was out here getting his PhD, and they had a student drop out of the project in early 2001. And they were scrambling to find somebody who had bear experience. And I had worked on a couple of UT projects as an undergraduate at Auburn. And he was calling people he knew that knew how to get out and trap. And so I was fortunately one of those people he called. And long story short, I drove to Oklahoma sight unseen and started in the spring of 2001 down in the Wachitas doing that work. So I moved out, I think it was in April, and bought all my supplies in Stillwater and came down here, and then had to start learning the study area and figure out where we wanted to do our trap lines.
Would that have been for your master's?
That was for my master's.
Okay.
So with the help of the ODWC folks down here, Jeff Ford was definitely integral in that. So you've known
Jeff for 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It's we've got quite a family here. Our bear bear people.
Yeah.
So I had to move down here. I had to learn the area. We had to figure out where we wanted our trap lines to go. And all of that kind of based in what we consider to be the core area of this Wachita population, which is in the National Forest in LaFleur County. Right.
Don't tell them that, Sarah. No, what's funny is in Oklahoma, we're talking about the topography and kind of the layout of the state. Like the Wachita Mountains infiltrate into Oklahoma in just really four or five counties. I mean, like mountainous stuff anyway. Like probably the foothills, the Wachitas probably go maybe into more counties than that. But it's just a pretty relatively small geographic area that would be considered mountainous. And most people wouldn't think of mountains when they think of Oklahoma. They certainly wouldn't think of what we're looking at here. I mean, this looks like the Appalachians or something.
I can tell you I did not. I mean, I grew up in the low country of South Carolina, and so I always thought Oklahoma was prairie. You know, I'm thinking dances with wolves, you know, like open prairie. And so to know that you could come here and find this kind of habitat. And the other neat thing about these mountains is that they are east to west running.
Yeah.
And so that we assume that that also kind of aided in the expansion from Arkansas of these right. bears into Oklahoma. Yeah. Obviously, they can climb up and down mountains. They don't have to have it running. But when you've got ridges that run from east to west,
yeah.
and the drainages are also doing that, it makes for an easy travel corridor, basically.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, yeah. What were you, so what were your objectives? Colby, I just almost nerded out on the Washtenaws right then.
I felt back. It coming.
I pulled back just a little bit. Oh, I got to
do it. I could cue you up.
Sarah, you may know this, but other people may not. The Washtenaws were, some of these mountains were once 10,000 feet. And this may be stuff you had heard.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these big mountains were 10,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
The Washtenaws were formed, the east-west running ridges was when South America bumped into North America. It buckled here, and the Gulf of Mexico used to come up to the Washita Mountains. Like it would have been a 10,000 foot highest peaks coastal range of mountains. And the erosion of the Washita Mountains, this is the way I understand it. Tell me if you know something different. Those mountains eroded over a bazillion years, and basically that erosion filled in what is now Western Mississippi, Louisiana, and East Texas. And so they call Louisiana the Washita Basin. So essentially, the erosion of the Washita Mountains, which would have been this massive coastal range, the erosion filled in the Gulf of Mexico. And so when you look on, there's certain, and I'm not really a geologist, but there was a time period when yeah, the Gulf of Mexico came up to like right here. We would be standing on mountains looking over the Gulf of Mexico.
So are you a runestone believer?
I don't know a ton about it.
I don't either. All I know is that they believe that the Vikings actually were in the Hevner area at one point back when the ocean okay. was supposed to be that close.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
they have what they believe were Viking runestones at that little park there.
Right.
I have not been there since grad school, so I can't give you all the complete details of it, but
I've never even stopped there. But when you said it, I remember mm-hmm. Hevner's known for the rune stones. We gotta right. stop there, Colby.
Mm-hmm.
What are we thinking? yeah, no, that fascinates me. But the east-west running ridges also make for unique habitat for bear, because it's these different angles that sunlight's hitting the forest. You know, the southern slopes are arid, the northern slopes are mesic, I guess, is, you know, more water, more thick vegetation.
It's really an interesting I tell people all the time, so our ridges might not be more than 3,000 feet,
right,
but this is some of the most rugged country you could ever wish for if you yeah. really get back in there, because yeah. you're dealing with really steep areas in right, most right. cases too. So it's not just that you have these rolling hills that happen to get up tall enough to be mountains.
Yeah.
They're kind of steep peaks that you're yeah. dealing with in particular. You can really see it if you say drive along that Talamina Drive.
Yeah.
And that's another good area to get to see the differences in the habitats that you're talking yeah. about too, and how short and scrubby the trees are when you get up on those really high peaks like that, because you're basically almost dealing with a desert type situation
yeah.
because there's not a lot of topsoil for
yeah.
those trees to really take root. And Oklahoma itself is incredibly diverse from the ecoregion
right.
standpoint. But this area down here, it's a second home to me. This is just I've never lived in mountains before I came here, but this is a good place to be, and it's
yeah.
been great for the bears, obviously.
Yeah. So back to where I was going before I got sidetracked by the Washtenaws. What were you trying to do with your initial research? What was the objective?
So my first research was sort of basic in the grand scheme of research these days. But the main goal was to come up with a population estimate
okay.
for the core area of the population, and then also to move forward with trying to see. We did collar back then; they were just VHF collars on females to get a feel for home ranges and habitat use. And then also the important thing about those collars is it allowed us to follow to dens and do the reproductive reproductive information that we needed for the population to see if it's in fact growing, that kind of thing.
So did you, going into it, did you have, or did anybody have any idea how many bears there were?
I mean,
there was no research, so nobody, but I mean, did anybody guess right?
I'm not sure if anybody did. I would imagine Joe Hempel and Jeff Ford probably had some ideas because of how long they had worked in this region, and they were the ones that would be dealing with any conflict issues that we might have. I don't recall. Now I've slept. I've slept a few days since then, but I don't recall coming into it if anybody said to me, you know, we're kind of thinking this is the amount.
Well, biologists, they don't like to guess, do they?
No.
See, normal people, like if you were just a normal person and not a biologist, and you had an objective to try to understand how many bears there were, I mean, me and Colby would be like taking bets, you know, like, I bet there's 1,000. I bet there's 5,000.
Yeah.
But you ask a biologist, and they're just like unbiased, like the research will show the way.
Amongst ourselves, we might have our own theories, but we definitely try to be very cautious about throwing that out in the general public. That's for sure. But you know, the other thing about it is I was working in a pretty restricted area, and so from my project we actually only estimated that there are about 85 bears
really
in the area that I was working in.
Now, you weren't doing DNA hair snares back then, were you?
It was, I helped set that up right after I finished my master's. A student came in and did the next stretch with the hair snares.
Did they have that technology when you started? Because now that's like the norm.
We collected hair from all of our, you know, we collected hair samples off of all of our captures and that kind of thing the same way we do now. And so I think it was definitely kind of becoming a more common practice.
Okay.
And
so how did y'all do it? How did you guys back then like determine density?
So for our population estimate, we use the Lincoln-Peterson model. And so it's from a capture-recapture study.
Can you break that down for me in a real simple way? Because I really don't know what it recapture. So
we had trap lines. I have ran 4 different trap lines in different areas. Then they would have, we used Aldrich snares, foot snares.
Which is a bucket snare?
No, this is before the bucket snares. These are a foothold snare with the same cable that the bucket snares use.
Okay.
But there, we build them into the ground. So you're making that bear step into a spot where you've got your pan set and catch them that way.
Gotcha.
Still attached to a tree, still with springs built in to protect them from injuries and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing when you're doing those is we're marking and recapture. That's what the Lincoln-Peterson does. So we capture individuals. We mark them with ear tags. We actually use several different methods. We do lip tattoos and ear tags because oftentimes they'll rip those ear tags out.
Mm-hmm.
And then some bears would get collars, of course. And so you're keeping track of all of those individuals, but also recaptures. And all of that information goes into, after 2 years of doing this work, you put it into this equation. That also takes into consideration, you know, is it a closed system? Are you still having bears moving in or out? Things like that. Lincoln-Peterson is probably like the most basic form of coming up with a population estimate. There are a million different great ways to look into it where, like our most recent student, Erica Perez, that you got to meet, she actually did some modeling for a current estimate down here where she actually incorporated not only her capture-recapture information, but also hunting season harvest, also survival and things like that from our collars that we put out. So you can just pile tons of great information in to then get a better feel for what you're really dealing with down here.
So back then, there was some correlation to how many times you caught the same bear.
Right.
That's kind of what you're saying.
That goes into,
if you caught the same bear 4 different times,
you're not thinking, catching a whole bunch of new bears.
Or
then,
if you never caught the same bear twice,
then that would mean something
right, bigger,
that maybe that there are more bears. Exactly. So if you're recapturing a bunch but not catching a whole lot of new ones, then that would probably go into that and give you a feel for, well, maybe there aren't as many bears here, you know. So we've kind of experienced that in certain portions up in our Ozark study area.
Right.
It's a smaller population that's just becoming established. And so once we trapped for a few years, man, we were just seeing a lot of recaptures and or photos
and that
would have
been
all of
in
our
2000,
marked bears.
That would have been around 2000, so almost, 20 years ago.
Well, for the Ozark population, that we started that research in 2011.
Okay.
But for here, and in fact, we believe we've actually started looking at the Ozark population at an earlier place in their recolonization than we did down
really?
Here in the early 2000s.
That's interesting.
You know, I described a recolonizing population, and we were looking at the expansion front right there in the core area down here in 2001, 2002.
And they were already here.
They were already here. But when we started in 2011 up in that Ozark region, we're catching that even earlier.
So you're starting to see an increase. Like
we would expect to start seeing an increase up there. And certainly we're getting right now up in that Ozark region, and I know we're kind of bouncing back and forth here. So
she's doing the typical biologist thing.
But in that
region,
we're
asking for the elementary stuff, and we're getting like the full scale thesis.
That's right. So in the Ozarks, right now, that population is basically totally reliant on the influx from the Arkansas side of things.
Right. So they're not. These bears here aren't going north and crossing I-40 and the Arkansas River.
Not that we've shown yet. Mm. So far, the Ozark and the Ouachita populations are distinct populations,
right,
and there's no flow back and forth. Now, can bears cross interstates and rivers? Absolutely. They don't really like to in many ways. And so it seems as though in both populations, they're expanding westward as opposed to north and south.
Mm.
Here, obviously, because of there's so many things that are so different about the Ozarks and the Ouachitas here. The Ouachitas are wonderful in that there's so much public land, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got all of this national forest that's, 500,000 acres or something, and that also comes from Arkansas over. And so the expanse of good habitat and not only the national forest, but then you've got also all of the timber companies and things like that. So you've got large blocks of forest down here.
Right.
When you're looking at the Ozarks in Oklahoma, it's highly fragmented. So we've got some really good habitat up there. There's the Cookson Wildlife Management Area that's close to 15,000 acres. Phenomenal bear habitat. But it's surrounded by a bunch of
just agricultural,
privately owned
cattle pasture.
Well, so in Sequoia, Cherokee, and Adair counties, there definitely is some cattle grazing and whatnot.
Right.
But that's those counties, there's a lot more forested area. And it's just broken up because of all the private ownership.
Right.
And so the good habitat is fragmented more. Now, around that Cookson Wildlife Management Area, there are some good blocks of property owners that have large properties, and with them butting up to that wildlife management area, man, that's provided a really good habitat for bears, and that's one of the good areas for them. But when you pull out and look at a larger scale, it's all fragmented, and it's a challenge. You know, we've found in some of our research that the female bears don't like that highly fragmented stuff, and they don't like to be. They don't like to be close to roads and highways, and they don't like to be close to human disturbance. So when you're looking at a species that is wholly reliant on females to make it stable and grow,
they're not choosing that fragmented habitat.
If they have the choice, they're going to want to be in those large blocks, those large contiguous blocks. And so that's just one of the management challenges that we have in the Ozarks And it's very different from what we're dealing with down here in the Wachitas.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you not notice that as much with male bears? They just kind of roam a little bit more freely? Or?
Yeah, they just cover all kinds of territory. Yeah.
And they're studying these females, watching where they den. That's yeah. You probably have more data on the females.
We've
too.
Got, so we are definitely, we've got way more collar data, mm-hmm. location data on females than we do on males in the state. Now, we were initially collaring males as well up in the Northeast, and actually we still are in the Ozark region. In fact, we're doing some really cool stuff now where we're actually collaring yearling bears to track their dispersal from the maternal home ranges.
Don't get too far ahead of me. I've still got questions about your original thesis, Sarah.
There's just too much good stuff.
I do too.
Yeah, we gave her an open door and she just took it. She took it and ran.
So the original research.
Well,
let me.
There's two questions I want to ask you.
Okay.
How many bears did you find out that there were?
So in two summers, we actually captured 51 individuals on my original trap lines.
In 2000, so 20 years ago.
2001, 2002. 20 years ago.
51.
I mean,
bears.
I haven't gotten any older, but you know, that was 20 years ago. So we captured 51 individuals. Our population estimate for the study area, and that's a big thing to key in on, is the fact that we're not saying
the whole
the
state
entire
of Oklahoma.
Wachitas have only 85 bears at that point. We were saying this study area that encompassed the home ranges of the females that I was collaring and the trap lines that I worked on was 85 or so bears.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, would that have been like one, like you don't have to give the specifics of it, like would that have been about the size of one of these counties over here?
It seems like, if I'm remembering correctly, it seems like the study area was defined as about 1,400 square kilometers or something like that.
Mm. Can you put that in American
form? Well,
check out
Science Made Simple, metric conversions.
Yeah, they can do that on their
She
iPhone.
Does it too.
Yes. So that's probably what, like square miles wise, that'd be what, maybe
half.
Like 600 or 700 square miles. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think something
so probably
like that.
like a county. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I'm just thinking of average. County,
and it wasn't, I mean, as far as LaFleur County is concerned, it was only a small portion of LaFleur County. And
okay,
I,
so
and
it was
never,
bigger. It was bigger than
it's,
that.
It's smaller than LaFleur County.
Oh,
you know,
oh got
you
it,
know,
got
my,
it.
My study area was smaller than mm-hmm. LaFleur County Understood. For sure, because it was just in a small portion of the National Forest in LaFleur County.
Okay, so we're going now.
So,
what's the most one
Wait,
bear
no,
has
no,
been recaptured?
You hold it. You hold it. Your question
really
is going to throw off the whole. You hold
okay,
it. Okay,
I'll wait. I'll hold it.
Here's my question.
Holding
what
it.
Was it like catching your first bear? So Ooh. you had never you didn't know this country. I presume you'd never seen an Oklahoma bear before, and you go out and you set these traps, and you catch a bear. I mean, that had to have been like an impacting thing to be like, holy smokes, this is a bear. Do you remember that?
What I can tell you is that there is no feeling that's better in this world than to have the opportunity to start a project like that from the ground up. Mm-hmm. So to be the one responsible to actually get in there, do the footwork, figure out where you think the best places for your lines are going to be, set those lines, train people that come out to work with you, set those lines.
Yeah.
And then begin capturing like we did. It's phenomenal. And
yeah,
it's still
a satisfying
thing. And not to keep jumping back and forth, but so I did that work in 2001 and 2002. And then when we got the new funding for the current projects started in 2014, I was then able to take Morgan Fander, a master's student, into those areas, and we started using those lines again to see how things had changed. And talk about full circle. I mean, it just,
yeah,
I can get emotional about it and get weepy anytime thinking about how incredible it was to have been a part of that original
pioneered mm-hmm. that research.
And then to be able to share it with other students and see how much farther they can take it now than I ever could have back mm-hmm. then.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The technology and that we have now and the intelligence of these students and the things that they bring to the project, it's just been a lot of fun.
In a 20-year time period, probably a lot of great stuff has happened. I mean, in terms of
gracious, for sure.
Of ability to interpret data and research and stuff. I mean, pretty big leaps and different things.
Absolutely.
But you still didn't answer my question, Sarah. when you walked up on the first bear, was that exciting?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm just messing with you.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first one? That's what I was asking.
Well, so I will tell you, I don't remember now specifically the first one.
Okay, that's okay. Well, you answered my questions.
But I do. Do you want me to tell you about our girl that I think Jeff actually mentioned in his podcast?
Yeah, sure.
So
hold your question, Colby.
She was only I think she was the third bear that we ever caught on my project in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
We name our bears because I don't like tracking numbers. So Bertha, yeah. Bertha is our
girl. Was she big?
No, I don't think she was especially big. She was only about 3 years old.
Yeah.
Then
I always associate big with Bertha.
Well, big Bertha. Now Bertha is big in terms of attitude and personality.
Oh, okay.
So Bertha definitely, and now she, as an adult bear, she is a good sized bear.
Okay.
But, so we caught Bertha. She was, I think, only the third bear that I ever caught down here starting that project. And Bertha showed back up in our project when we started trapping in 2014 down here.
Exciting.
And we still have Bertha collared.
She's still alive.
She's still alive. She's not had cubs the last 2 years, which makes us very sad, but she's still in incredible condition.
So
and still alive.
You think she's 23 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you caught her that first year. And she's still alive.
It's yes.
Amazing.
And
do you
I
have
would have
any
never,
idea?
When we started back in 2014, of course I had all the old numbers and data that I passed. Actually, I don't even think I'd passed it off to the grad student then to Morgan, because it just didn't even occur to me that we'd start seeing these bears. And luckily, the tattoos lasted long enough that we ended up, I think, with 6 or 8 different bears that I marked in my study that showed up again in our studies here.
That's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
That's very neat.
But Bertha is, if I was going to have a favorite bear, she is definitely the favorite. Yeah. So she stands
what's
out.
What's the oldest bear that you guys know of in Oklahoma?
I think she's it. Best we can tell, she's around.
I'm
she's
pretty sure
be.
In Arkansas, that's around the age of the oldest documented bear.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard Randy Cross up in Maine talk about 30-plus-year-old bears. I've seen some of his stuff that he's written. That's old. That's
and
pretty cool.
It's tricky. You've got to have, you know, what we found out, the aging with the tooth, the cementum annuli, is really good. But we've also found, having marked her back in 2001, and as a younger bear, it's more trustworthy, that process is. So we knew she was likely 3 or 4 at that point.
Yeah.
So then when they actually aged this second time around in 2014, it didn't peg her as old as she really was.
But, that's interesting.
That is
but
interesting.
I don't know. I don't know if we have.
She's probably running out of teeth to age.
Well, it's you know, they wear them down. I mean, they spend half of their lives eating acorns.
Yeah.
And walnuts and things like that. So it's going to wear them down.
Yeah, yeah.
And the one that we use is such a tiny little premolar.
Mm-hmm. Could you use other ones? That's just the easiest one to get to?
It's the one that they're not using.
Right. It's always it's the most
so
obscure
tiny,
tooth they own.
It's a tiny one right behind that canine.
Right.
And they're actual, I guess they technically have 4 because you can technically take one from the bottom. The top is where we usually pull from because that's usually the easiest to pop loose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not even a quarter of an inch root and all once we get it out of the mouth. And so that's the reason we use those because it's not going to inhibit their
always their wondered
foraging.
Why they use that one, but that makes I presumed that was why.
It's virtually vestigial, basically. You know, it's virtually something that they're not using anymore. It's like our appendix, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
it's still
there. Maybe it served a purpose or still could help a little bit, but it's so tiny that it's pretty much inconsequential.
But you could annuli any tooth, I guess.
That's a good question, but I believe so.
Okay.
I mean, they're all growing from the time that they lose them as babies and get their adult teeth, and they're going to...
Yeah. You know, Randy Cross told me one time that we were talking about tooth aging animals. He basically said, you can't put much stock in tooth wear, just visible tooth wear. I wondered if you had any correlation with this. Like, because he said we might, he said they might be working with a 5-year-old bear that has like rotten teeth and has broken canines and busted up. And then they might have a 15-year-old bear that has a fairly pristine set of teeth. Because, you know, the generalization would be, oh, that bear's old. Its teeth are wore down and broken. I mean, probably most of the time that's true. But he said there were notable exceptions that made him not give much credit to just tooth wear. And I'm not talking about annuli, cementum annuli. I'm just talking about visible tooth wear.
For sure.
And he thought it was genetics. He thought it was just like humans, just like some people are prone to more tooth decay than others. Mm. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting.
I could definitely see that. I mean, I guess that's with most wildlife species. It's like we've got this great formula for aging deer, but it depends on the region that you're in and
how many rocks they're chewing.
So it's the same idea with bears. We always, I mean, we're biologists, so we've got a data sheet that's just chock full of stuff that we write down, and we make notes about what their tooth wear looks like and if there's anything odd to report. And so I think it gives us something to go by, just if we're accustomed to seeing bears in the Wachitas and what their teeth usually look like. It has some bit of a spectrum for us that, you know, we can say, well, most likely it's within this range or something. But absolutely, I mean, there's genetics, there's what that particular bear eats a lot of.
Maybe it did something different than a bear 30 miles away.
Right,
A different diet.
And like
Colby,
I said,
what's your question? I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna say, like I said, I mean, when they're sitting there spending so much time crunching on acorns and walnuts and things like that, you just never know.
Do you remember how long it took you to catch your first bear?
Oh.
From when you started?
I do not remember specifically, but it seems as though within the first week.
Whoa. She's a good trapper.
Because we only run each line for a couple of weeks apiece. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, we would work for 2 weeks running those lines, and then we'd take a couple days off to just do telemetry or whatever, and then we'd set the next line.
Yeah. Sounds like a fun research project to start up.
It really was. And
if you love the outdoors.
And such a beautiful place, you know. Of course, I think it was that very first line that also gave all of us a huge case of poison ivy. Because the absolutely perfect trap tree that I found was covered, but I wasn't willing to give it up. So we ripped out a bunch of poison ivy and consequently all ended up in Fort Smith at the doctor.
Oh, no.
Getting shots.
I've had that shot before.
Because we were so miserable. But we caught bears there.
Yeah.
In fact, the first bear we caught there, we named Ivy because
of that. I'll be darn. That's a good
name. What's the funniest name you've given a bear?
Oh,
It's interesting.
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if we have. Oh, I do know one. So I've heard you talk with somebody about how to pronounce the Wachitas and how so many people mispronounce it. And back then we used to laugh because people would say Wachitas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So we called one of our bears Wachita.
Nice.
Oh, that's just like a stab in the back.
So, Wachita. So, and of course it's spelled exactly like Wachita, but you had to call her Wachita, not
Wachita. That's funny. That's good. That's good. I like that. I've got a bear naming story that involves Sarah.
Okay.
And it ties right in. This is a beautiful segue into den research. Mm-hmm. So the one time I went with you guys on a den research project or a den visit, well, I think it was 2015. I think it was 5 years ago. May have been 2016.
It would have been 2016, I think, because that's when Erica and Morgan were with us.
Okay, 2016.
Erica Perez and Morgan. Fandom.
So 4 years ago. And so we were going into a sow that you've done so many. I don't know if you even remember it, but we were going into a sow that didn't have cubs.
Yeah, we thought she was too young to have cubs.
Yeah, and so we walk all the way back in there, and the whole time it's like, and the cool thing about it was if it had cubs, I probably wouldn't have even been on the trip. Part of the reason I got to go was they were like, hey, this isn't that important. You're not that important. so you can come with us on this one.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay your dues.
Yeah. And so, and I was grateful just to be there. And so we went up, and I mean, it's a pretty cool process to like watch you guys work in that scenario, because you know pretty much where the bear's at, and probably in this case, that I think Morgan knew exactly where it was at. They had already gone in and located the den in this rock cavity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have to kind of sneak up, kind of be quiet. But these bears are unusually sedate, you know, just naturally in the den. Like, that's what's not – people either think they're dead asleep and you could just walk up to them and poke them with a stick and they wouldn't even wake up. Or when you tell them that they're, like, cognizant and, like, they're like looking at you out of the den with their head up. Like, you know, you're like, well, why aren't they running off? So anyway, you sneak up to this den and kind of move in quiet. And then I think Morgan darted the bear, I think with an air gun. It may have been a jab stick.
We usually use a jab stick, but okay, I think I stayed back and let you guys go up there, but usually we use a jab stick.
Yeah, she used a jab stick. I remember putting it together now. So she has this like spear with a syringe on the end of it.
Mm.
Poke this bear. And the bear just lets you do that. And
some of them do.
Yeah. But what was cool about this one is that there were cubs. Mm. So once we get up there, Morgan's like, there's cubs in there. And there wasn't supposed to be cubs. And this was a bear going into its third, was it like a 2.5-year-old? It would have been in the spring. So it'd been a 3-year-old.
She would have turned 3 already, yep.
So that's pretty young for a bear
to be. So that meant that she bred at 2 and then had her first litter at 3. And we've had that happen in the Ozarks in particular. We've had that happen before.
Right.
But it's not incredibly common. They usually say between 3 and 5 is when they first breed.
I want to come back to that very point, but I got to finish the story.
Mm-hmm.
While Morgan and I were, y'all stayed back just a little bit, just so it'd be less ruckus.
Just sent you and Erica and Morgan up, I think, so that we only have a few people that go in on the sedation team.
Mm-hmm. And right at like the peak moment of intensity, like we see the den's like right there, Morgan goes, there's a camera. There was a like 1970s style full frame 35mm Canon camera laid on a rock as if Rumpelstiltskin in 1979 had laid that camera there. And it had been untouched for, it was old.
Mm-hmm.
This camera's just laying there. And she says, there's a camera. And we're in the middle of nowhere. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do.
And
I hope she still has that camera.
I heard Jeff Ford has it.
Oh, he might, yeah.
So we got to do the job. So we're like, take note, like, okay, there's a camera. We got to come back and see what's up with this. Anyway, we go in and do all the den work. And then I think after we got her sedated, somebody walked over there, and you know Morgan saw it, so it was, you know, it was hers, you know, and it was crazy cool, and we named that cub Canon because it was a Canon camera,
mm-hmm.
And one of the cubs was color phase.
They were tiny,
and a color phase. I remember one of them looked almost silver, and mm-hmm. that's the one we named Canon. But anyway, it was just, I've never had that happen in all my outdoor adventures to find something quite that unique. And as I followed up with Morgan later, and she wasn't able to, like, the film was like unsalvageable,
mm-hmm.
but she tried to get it open. But anyway, it was kind of neat,
mm-hmm.
but yeah.
You never know what you're going to find out in these woods. You know,
it's,
I'm always hauling treasures in, but usually it's rocks and feathers and things like that. But
yeah. Well, I'd like to know the story of the person that lost that. Okay, the breeding age of these bears being 2 and 3, like, what does it indicate when there's young females getting bred?
So what we suspect, like I said, it's usually that we've seen it the most up in our Ozark region, although we have seen it down here in the Ouachitas a little bit. But in that particular case, you would expect that there are fewer females, and so those younger ones can actually become bred at an earlier age so that the males are actually covering younger females.
Right, right.
And there's a lot that goes into it as well in terms of interpreting. You know, a lot of times those younger females have a harder time actually raising off that first litter because there's got to be some learning curve, right? I mean, mm-hmm. If they're still only just now turning 3 years old and have only spent, you know, 6 months or 9 months on their own, then them having to also teach cubs is a challenge for them.
Right.
Some do a great job and some don't. But yeah, it's been an interesting thing to see. Now down here in the Wachitas, I believe that most of the time their first breeding is around three.
And this is a more stable population, though.
Correct. There are more bears here. It's still growing, but it's still kind of a more stable, and there are more bears and more adult females to choose from. Now, not that the male bears are at all choosy.
Yeah.
They're just covering as many as they possibly can. But there's just that competition.
What's the coolest like home range bear story that you can recall? So you've been around some of these research projects with like bears, and I'm sure you've heard about this bear that's come down from like Wisconsin and is now in eastern Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about that?
Briefly. I don't know a whole lot about it, but
that's all I know is what I just told you.
Right.
But they've been tracking this bear down through the Midwest, and he's ended up in like the lower White River drainage in Arkansas from Wisconsin, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, so one thing that I should mention about collars that is really important to bring up about because we learn so much more now these days being able to have access to the technology we have. So when I was in graduate school, I referred to only having a VHF collar, which means it only has a radio signal and you have to get out there and manually track that collar
right.
and triangulate. You have to have really good mapping skills. And, you know, so you're out there having to do the work to get any locations. So you can imagine, because of the time that it takes to actually get enough readings on a certain bear and get a location on it, that your hands are tied to where you probably got, maybe I got three locations per bear per week, something like that, when I had 15 big collars out or so.
Yeah.
And that's tracking 6 days a week, you know, so there's a lot of effort that goes into getting just a handful of locations and data. Now we're using satellite collars. And so we can have those collars. I mean, they can be programmed to take locations every 30 minutes if we wanted to, but most of ours take them. Now on our yearling bears, we're taking them every few hours. On our adult bears, we're taking them every 6 or 7 hours so that you're getting locations at different times a day. Now, we aren't getting those locations every single time it makes an attempt, but you can see that if I'm supposed to be getting three locations per day and only get two, that's still
light years ahead of where you were.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so what we thought was happening back then based on VHF work, now we're really getting to see a lot of movement that we wouldn't have gotten before. So we've had one female in our Ozark region that primarily was in an area, let's say 8 miles by 8 miles. That was her home range for the most part. In that,
I appreciate you putting that in miles rather than kilometers.
Working around in that area, that's where she lived. But every fall, for about a week or two, she would make this jaunt into Arkansas, which was probably where she was going, was probably as a crow flies 30 miles away or so. Mm. And she'd go over there, and then she'd come back and den back in Oklahoma again.
In the fall.
Mm-hmm. And so we never were able, actually, we should pull that data up and maybe we could get over there now that we've been...
To see what she was going to.
We've been working with, yeah, of course, it's been so long now.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you could say, well, maybe there's a feeder over there that she's going to, a wildlife feeder or something, but she was surrounded by plenty of wildlife feeders in her home range.
Mm.
She was in an area that had plenty of good oaks, you know, so...
For some reason,
but there was
she
something
won.
Over there that she would take this jaunt and then come back.
Do you think it could have been like where she was raised or where she came from?
It very well, a maternal home range or something, maybe. Yeah. You know, certainly that's close enough that you know, she could have potentially come from that area.
Yeah.
For sure. But why she wouldn't have set up shop more in Arkansas than, right. you know,
because
they don't typically disperse that far from the maternal home ranges. The females don't.
Would you say it's pretty standard? Like, well, I don't want to get ahead of you on the other interesting stories, but like, give me a generalization on bear home range here. Like,
okay,
size.
So they're pretty large here. What we're probably looking at is around 38 square miles or so for females.
Really?
And 170 or so square miles for males.
Wow, they're really traveling.
Or bigger. I mean, we actually down here, I believe there's an estimate that was even close to like 250 square miles.
Is that, so Laura Conley in Missouri told me something similar, and that surprised me. Because it may be 20, maybe 10, even 10 years ago, some of the research that was being, at least in general terms, what I was hearing in Arkansas, the bear range wasn't that big. And I don't know if that, you know, sometimes one person says something as a generalization and then you hear that and then you start repeating it. And before you know it, it's science when really it never was. So, but that's really a big home range.
There's a lot of variation. I mean, that is definitely something to keep in mind, is that, between individual bears and their area within the population, you know, their home range size is wholly tied to the resources that they need to survive on an annual basis.
So that's what they need to survive?
Well, it's just, it can be in a very small area. It could be 3 square miles if they could find all of their annual food stuff
right.
within that 3 square miles. If they can find their water, they've got good denning, all of that. It can be very small, but they need to be able to, I mean, these are very large animals in general that live off of nuts and berries, basically. And yeah. so imagine
big areas,
how much they have to forage to get enough blackberries for a day or acorns for a day, that kind of thing. So it's really a function of the habitat and how much area they have to cover in general. Now, males, it also has to do with them traveling
breeding.
To breed.
Yeah.
The females aren't going to take off. And they're now their summer home ranges are larger than the fall. Usually the fall usually kind of, gets a little more compact. So the female home ranges in the summer are bigger than the fall. Males are obviously way bigger in the summer than they are in the fall,
right.
because summer is the breeding season. And so they really put the pedal to the metal and are out hoofing.
That's a massive area. You know, I wonder if sometimes I've thought about like kind of like an anomaly, like what you just described, like this sow that just had this home range and she just went over and did something crazy and then would come back. I wonder if adaptation and evolution have some way rewarded kind of just something that seems erratic, but there was a biological advantage to, like, if you think about it like this, like maybe something catastrophic would happen in a certain area and the bear that wasn't there when it happened survived.
Right.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
So like, because you see these, like, we kind of want to take wildlife and make them into this like cardboard cutout. I do anyway. I know you're a biologist, so you don't, but I do. And so it's like a bear he's in this home range. He's going to stay here. But then you hear this stuff. And I'm, you know, Jeff Ford told us a story about this bear that went like 70 miles
Rambler.
One way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We called him Rambler after that.
And, you know, and so you know, you think, well, a home range is a reflection of what that bear needs to survive and nothing more. Like, that's what I think. Or, you know, that's what I want to think.
What you want to think, right?
Like, so, but Rambler, he bypassed a ton of great habitat, probably full of food source, to go over there for whatever. This mm-hmm. Your bear did the same thing. So, like, I just wonder if there's, like, something rewarded inside of random, you know, eccentricity inside of a bear.
Absolutely.
Or any animal species, maybe.
Well, and to us, it appears to be erratic.
Right.
But there's a reason that they're making those moves.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, we've worked to try to get at why they choose different den types, right? Why, when you've got, say, crevices and you've got hollow trees and you've got good brush piles, why would they ever just go den in a ground nest? You know, why yeah. would they do that? It seems ridiculous to us, but somehow it's working for them.
Right.
And they've made those choices. And so we just have to do the best we can at looking at all the variables to try to flesh out why they're making these moves
yeah.
and these decisions that they're yeah. making. And maybe it is random, you know, maybe we try to put too much into it.
Yeah.
But I like to think that, I mean, sort of supporting your theory. I mean, I like to think that there's a reason for their movements. We just haven't seen it yet. We just
yeah.
haven't quite fleshed it out.
Yeah. It's such a mystery. That is the one thing that it's so cool about these animals, especially when we have this kind of research and data like we have now, like these GPS collars, is you get to unveil just a little bit of the mystery to see what they're doing.
Right.
Do you have any other cool home range stories? I kind of interrupted you.
Well, I was going to mention Rambler and his movements. Actually, Courtney Dotterwich, our PhD student down in the Wachitas, just sent me a map the other day of our girl Bertha that I was just talking about.
The old one.
And so she is within our original core area here and has been really consistent over the years. I mean, we literally were catching her like at the same trap sites that we did
wow.
from back in the early 2000s. And but she took a jaunt south that appears to be new this summer compared to what she's done before. And now, again, I will say that she has not had cubs the last couple of years.
Hmm.
And so maybe her movements might be a little bit different now that she's older and potentially not having cubs. We're still holding out hope for this next year.
Hmm.
But she just took a jaunt south, and I'm trying to think it's a good 10 or 12 miles from kind of her normal area.
Hmm.
We speculate
empty nest syndrome.
We speculated that maybe she was making her way down to the little cafe to get a burger and fries and a milkshake or something,
yeah,
since she
yeah.
didn't have to deal with kids. But
exactly,
you know.
Yeah, empty nest, empty nest. Yeah, dens. Is there? Where do they primarily den?
Oh gosh, they use so many different types of dens. I already kind of spouted off a few of them. It seems to be a little bit different between the Wachitas and the Ozarks, but that is only because the availability of crevice type or cave type dens in the Ozarks. They're more available up in the Ozarks because of the geology in that area.
It's really ledgy and stuff up there.
So we get a lot, you know, we definitely get more of them in those types of dens there. But primarily we see a lot of ground excavations. So in the side of a hill, they literally will dig out a spot big enough for them to curl up in. Down here, we get a lot more in like the hollow bases of trees.
Hmm.
Sometimes in elevated, what I would call elevated tree dens, where they actually have to go into a hole up 20 or 30 feet up and
really?
Then down.
We've
into
got
the
some
trim,
trees
so
that big around here that have those kind
we
of cavities.
We do. And it's kind of crazy because they actually don't have to be as big as you would envision them. I mean, basically like mama bear is in there sitting here and that's about as much space as she's probably got.
Huh. Now you can't hardly get to those bears though for.
We have not. All we have done is actually we've done GoPro. We track them. And then if we can climb the tree, if we can get up there, we try to shoot a GoPro in there and see what's
going on.
Yeah, if that just to say, okay, does she have cubs or not? If we can't climb it, we also leave game cameras up there so that we can try to see who comes out.
Yeah,
just so we
yeah.
know if she ends up having cubs or not. Usually, those dens like that are going to be a female that's going to have cubs, not one that has yearlings.
Right,
space
smaller,
issue,
smaller mm-hmm. den.
Right.
Yeah.
So lots of ground excavations. We've got the crevice dens up in the Ozarks. What I call just kind of rock dens. So just spaces under the big boulders.
Right. Now that would be here.
We
that was
see
like
those
that
more here.
Female that I was with y'all.
Right.
On. It was just like a rock pile.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have looked at it and thought, oh, that's a bear den. It was just a space. I mean,
right.
probably 12, 14 inches tall and. You know, kind of obscure shaped, but maybe 2 or 3 feet wide. I mean, just enough for somebody to just kind of get half their body down in there. I was always real interested, and still am. The more bear dens that I've seen, the more interested I am in them. But most people don't understand what these look like.
No, probably if you're in the woods in the wintertime very much at all in a place that has bears, you've probably walked past bear dens and never had a clue.
Yep.
It's unbelievable the spaces that they choose. Actually, one of our coolest crevice dens that we have recorded so far was actually down here in the Ouachitas. And she was so far, I mean, it was a tight squeeze. You had to be comfortable with spelunking to get into her. And we actually ended up, because of the angle and where she was, we tried to dart her because she was so far back in there. But the angle, the darts kept kind of glancing off of rock and whatnot. We ended up putting two jab sticks together. So like a 16-foot long jab stick and feeding it, like, talk about teamwork. It was phenomenal. We made it work and were able to sedate her. And then get down in there, and those are
there's not many caves like that here. Was it a cave? Would you call it a cave?
It was technically a cave or a crevice.
Was it like a crack in a big kind of bluff?
It was in the side of a hill, and it's almost like a fissure, you know, where it had, like, maybe that's what was going on, is that, you know, to get down into it, basically, like, you're squeezing yourself, like, you just have to slide down in, and then it kind of opens up and moves around. But she was down in there, like I said, it was, our jab pole was 16 feet when all was said and done, and we were hanging down into it. Our graduate student, Will Childress, was actually kind of laying down into the entrance using that jab stick. So, I mean, she was down in there a good ways. Mm. And we've had some really neat ones up in the Ozarks that are similar, where you're like having to crawl into a tunnel to be able to even do the sedation and that kind of thing. But typically it seems as though they're going to have smaller dens when they have cubs. And then when they're back in there with yearlings, then they usually pick a little bit larger spaces.
They have bigger space.
But that's not written in stone. Nothing out here is. But yeah. That's usually what
have
we
you
see.
Ever had any real close calls with bears? Like one, like, getting ugly with you?
Some of the girls get pretty saucy with us in the den season. they take exception. You know, what you were saying about how calm they are, and that's, I'd say, 85-90% of the time.
Right.
They look at you, they know you're there, they might huff a little bit, and then mostly they turn away from you and say, well, I'll just pretend like you're not there and maybe you'll go away.
Right.
You know, they really just, they don't want to mess with you. Yes, they can come out. They could get you if they wanted to, but mostly they just want you to go away. But we definitely have certain ones that have been, I mean, they swat and bite at the jab stick, and we primarily use the aluminum jab pole, and that can go anywhere from, I think they're like 3 foot sections or so, 2.5 or 3 foot sections. So we can get it up to about 8 or 9 feet if we need to. We prefer that method too. We do have fancy dart projectors and things like that when we need to. But a lot of our areas, it's so thick getting into them that you have to get just about as close with the dart projector as you do with your jab stick anyway.
Yeah.
So we have so much more control over the placement of our, you know, of our syringe and things like
with the jab stick
than we do. I mean, as I mentioned, with the dart projector, I mean, you just have all kinds of weird things that happen depending on angles and things like that.
Yeah.
And so even an excellent marksman can still mess up with that.
Yeah. So you've never been attacked by a bear?
I have never been attacked by a bear. I've had a bear that wanted to eat me.
Yeah.
You're asking
that.
About memorable bears, and I think everybody that's worked with them has a story probably about certain ones, and this is one that was down. It was on my second trap line of the summer in grad school, and he was probably a 3-year-old male. And those guys tend to think that they're pretty tough stuff and they have something to
prove. They're the troublemakers.
They're
aren't
the ones
they?
That think they have something to prove. You know, the big older males like our boy Skip that's over 500 pounds, he just sits there and looks at you like, I know I'm the king of the forest. No big deal. You don't scare me. But when you have those young males, they're the ones that kind of get pretty feisty sometimes. But he was, thank goodness we had a good catch on him, because he was lunging back and forth between my technician and myself, like coming after us. And he was really rangy, had long legs. And so he had a really good reach on him. And I was doing the jab. And I mean, he'd rush right at me and slap at the jab stick. And then he'd turn around and he'd do the same thing with my technician, who had a stick trying to keep his attention and that kind of thing. And so I mentioned that we had 51 bears, individual bears, captured those 2 years. And of those 51, he's the one that I would not want to have bumped into in a berry patch. You know, I feel like they all have a certain amount of fight in them when they're backed into a corner, certainly. But his behavior was totally different.
Yeah, he was pretty aggressive.
And then we've got a female up in the Ozark region that her name is Christy. But she is
sorry for all the Christies out there.
She is no angel. and the cool thing about her was that we the last time that we worked a den with her, she had a male and a female cub, which is typical. And the little female cub was just as saucy as Christy is. Like, usually, you know, they just want to curl up and go to sleep or whatever. But that little girl, it was a little bit later in March, and so she was older and a little bit bigger, and she already had the, like, pat the ground with her front feet and huff at you. And, I mean, she had all of the big bear stuff down.
You know,
and
what?
The little male just laid and slept in your arms, but she was not. She was biting us for, like, when we were trying to take measurements
you
and
know,
stuff.
I did a story, and I'd interviewed Randy Cross specifically about an idea that he had. And I don't know if you're familiar with Randy Cross, but he's the bear biologist, he's retired now, but a reputable bear biologist in Maine.
Yeah.
So we did a story on, and he contacted me. Well, no, I didn't. I contacted him, but he had this bear named Sarah that they had had for like, 20, they had a, she lived to be, no, Sarah only lived to be 15. Long story short, the whole point of Sarah, she was that captured and lived her life back in like the 80s. She was one of the first bears they captured when they first started doing research in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And basically all her progeny to this day are exceptionally long lived as compared to other bears. So they have this massive research project that's now been going on for 40 years. Mm-hmm. So they've just have all this incredible data. What he believes is that the nurture, quote unquote, like what a female bear teaches her cubs about how to be a bear, not what's necessarily innate in them that just is in their DNA, is really important, because basically generations later, Sarah's progeny are living like twice as long as the average bear in Maine. And he, you know, I'd have to read the story again to get the exact quotes from Randy, but Sarah was, she was not killed over a bait, I don't think, because that's what they were trying to determine is, How are these bears surviving our baited bear hunts? Mm-hmm. And basically, he believed that she had a negative interaction at a bait site when she was young, and that spooked her so bad that she avoided bait sites her whole life, and she taught her young to do that because that's what they're finding. Because, like, most of the mortality in Maine is from hunting over bait, which, I mean, it's a management tool. That's a positive thing. Like, that's how the bears are being harvested. That's how they're managing their population. And to this day in 2020, Sarah's progeny are not getting killed over bait.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And that's getting back to what I was saying about, you know, the younger females and their ability to raise up and teach their cubs what they need to know to be bears.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's, and you see, and I don't think it's always age related, but certainly you would think that younger ones would have a little bit harder go of it than the older females do. But, But yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, that's why it's so females and bear populations. Females are so important. We're a little biased. If you're a bear biologist, you're a little biased. You like the girls, and that's because they are the sole factor that is allowing a population to be stable and or growing. So it's that those females and their recruitment of other females, right?
Right.
And so they're not only important in terms of having the cubs, but they're important in making sure that those cubs actually survive to become productive members of bear society.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty incredible. It really is. Sarah, is there anything that we've not talked about that you would like to?
Oh, well, I would like to. Yeah, I think the thing that I'd like people to walk away from with this, I mean, we could talk bears all day long, and I do. But as far as Oklahoma management is concerned, you know, we touched on the fact that the Ozark and the Ouachita populations are distinct and separate populations. And we touched on the fact that the landscape in those regions is so different. And that's just an important thing for people to think about, you know, if you're a sportsman and you're interested in hunting, or you're hearing about the management plans here in Oklahoma for bears, just to consider that, yeah, just because we have 1,100 or 1,200 bears in the Ouachitas doesn't mean that you can manage the Ozark population the same way. So the ODWC, and this is a big reason why they work so closely with us at OSU, you know, they're working hard to manage these populations separately because of their different needs.
So you're saying don't get upset if you can't hunt bear in the Ozark
right
portions
of
Oklahoma.
We can't hunt there just yet, because everything that we've shown from our den visits and our captures show that there are not enough females, and there's not enough female recruitment in that population for it to be a stable population in and of itself. So if
that
we weren't
sense.
Still getting bears coming over expanding from Arkansas, then we wouldn't be seeing much of a growth in that area.
Yeah.
And so we've got to consider that. And we have every interest in, you know, the story down in the Ouachitas. It's just such a conservation success story, right? You know, to be able to have this population that we can hunt now and give people the opportunity, and it's still a growing population, even with that.
Yeah,
that
that's
happening.
What I wanted to ask you about that.
It's just super exciting to know that we can give people the opportunity to hunt the species and still know that we're not negatively impacting that population.
Right.
And that's what we would like to see in the Northeast in that Ozark region. We just have to give it time. But then the management is still going to have to be different up there, just because there are a lot more people and because of that fragmented habitat. So it will just be a totally different management scheme than what we're seeing down here in the Ouachitas.
And down here, we can bait bear on private land now. And like, it used to be just four counties, but now they've expanded that to, I don't know, 10 or 12 counties.
Yeah, they went to highway markers instead of county lines for this southeast region. Makes more sense, because you don't know when you cross a county line when you're in the woods necessarily.
Yeah.
I mean, even with that expanded area, quite frankly, the expanded area that's now included in the hunting season,
not going to be that productive.
There's not that many bears out there just yet. I mean, there will be at some point. And what will be out there are males, most likely. And so for hunting purposes, that's fantastic. You know? You can have the
opportunity. So the population is growing west. It's moving west and moving south.
And that's part of what we're looking at now. Courtney Dotterwich is going to be looking at. We've moved out of the core area for trapping, and now we're looking into some of those more expanded areas to see kind of how that density changes as we move west. Or the population size or density is moving and changing. And then where we kind of see that the females stop and it's just males, you know, trying to get a feel for what we're looking at right now.
So they think there's only about 1,100 bears in Oklahoma?
In the Ouachita population, the most recent from our research is about 1,200 bears.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's a relatively small area, but
And I know you were asking about density and some of the other podcasts you've done, and that is.
And nobody ever gives me a good answer, Sarah.
I got one for you.
Drum roll.
Okay, so from our early studies and like the 2014, 2015 work, it looks like there's about, I think they reported about 11.4 bears per about 38 square miles.
Okay.
Now, so I heard you throwing out the is there one bear per one square mile kind of thing. That shows that that's even less. And that's really kind of for the core area.
Okay. So that's where they're thick.
That's where they're the thickest, right?
Less than a bear per square mile.
But now we have to take that with a grain of salt. I mean, we're having to say this is within our study area. So based on home ranges of the females and based on where our trap lines are. So it's within that area and it's just with like one snapshot in time, right?
Right.
So.
Because at any given time, what's so deceiving about that is you might go on that mountain right there and there may be three or four bears there
right.
at one time. I mean, you might
right.
see them.
You've
you might
got
get
one
pictures
big,
of
if
them.
If you've got one big clear cut and it's loaded down with blackberries or pokeberries, depending on the time of year, then there are probably going to be more than one bear out in that big clear cut because that's where the food
but
source
statistically,
is.
But statistically, for the amount of land, not even one bear per square mile.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. You did a great job with that.
Well,
you're the very first.
Well, Morgan Fander did a great job. Okay. That's what these
no,
graduate
if Morgan
students
was
put
here,
together.
I'm going to throw her right on the bus. She would have tried to complicate it.
Well, but they're the ones out there doing the hard work and giving us all this good information. So
yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. That's really cool. Colby, any thoughts, any questions?
Yeah. Oh, what's some of the other research projects that you guys have done?
Or what's going on now, maybe?
Or what's going on now. What was the research project that, you know, was the biggest surprise or, you know?
The new thing that's happening right now, well, I already mentioned that Will Childress is starting to, we just started collaring yearlings to track for that. And mm-hmm. so we're new into that project and don't have any data on that yet. Mm. Not all put together yet. But that's very exciting. We're excited to see that information should tell us how they're going to expand into this new region in the Ozarks, right? Since we're mm-hmm. right at the beginning of that recolonization, it'll give us a better feel by tracking both the males and the females to see how they move into the available habitat that's there. Mm-hmm. So that's really exciting. Something that we're not very happy about, but that we're looking into is the cases of sarcoptic mange in that Ozark region.
Mm.
It's happening in Arkansas. We've worked with Myron Means as well. We kind of are trying to collaborate and everybody's scratching our heads trying to figure this out. But so part of the new research also is showing what we're doing is we're pulling blood samples and skin scrapings from every bear we have our hands on, both in the Ozarks and the Ouachitas. We're mm-hmm. not seeing it in the Ouachitas yet, fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mm-hmm. happen down here. So we're pulling those samples in the hopes of maybe seeing what the underlying conditions are and why certain mm-hmm. bears in that region are susceptible.
You know, we had a guy write in asking about, you may not have seen it,
mm-mm.
He asked me to ask somebody about mange and bears in Arkansas, and I forgot about it, but you just answered it. What did you call it? Sarcoptic?
It's sarcoptic mange.
And it makes them look bald.
Like what coyotes mm-hmm. get, that kind of
yeah.
thing. That's the ones that look horrible. I mean,
and it can kill them.
It can. And we believe that we've had, this is anecdotally, but we believe that we've lost a bear or two females to it because they had it so bad going into den season that it really takes its toll. They can't put pack on the pounds like they need to. They lose all of their hair. They're itchy. They don't end up staying in their dens. We've had several
yeah.
that we've tracked. They don't stay in their dens because they're hungry, one,
yeah.
and because it's got to be uncomfortable. Now, so it can kill them, but then there are also cases where they seem to have recovered.
They come out of it. You know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that this is, you know, there's a lot of research going into mange with bears right now.
Does it happen in other places?
It is, yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So Wisconsin, Pennsylvania was the closest to us until we got it here. But it's happening all across the country. There's a lab at University of Georgia that's actually kind of the center for all of the research for the mites and trying to figure this out. And they've even found that, you know, conventional wisdom was that the mites didn't last very long off of a host, like a couple of hours would be a long time. But what they found recently is that those mites in the right conditions can actually live up to 2 weeks off of a host.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then, I mean, you can only imagine if we're congregating bears at wildlife feeders,
right,
you know, things like that, then there's the potential for spread.
Mm-hmm.
So there are just a million questions that we have about this, and hopefully we can look into this even more.
Yeah.
But at least right now, Will Childress has spearheaded, and we've started taking these samples, and hopefully we can see if there are any underlying differences between the populations.
Right, or maybe it's just they're there and it's just not here yet. I had a guy last fall, I'd almost forgotten about this, a friend of mine sent me a picture, and it was his friend that had this picture of a hairless, it was a crazy sight. If you would have shown this picture to 10 people and said, what animal is this? You know, probably 8 people would have got it wrong. But an absolutely hairless bear, emaciated. I mean, you could see its ribs. And this guy was deer hunting, feeding deer up in the Ozarks in Madison County. And this bear was just like living on his corn pile for his deer and like wouldn't leave. I mean, the bear was about to die.
It needed it.
And this guy messages to me and said, hey, send this to Myron Means. And so I messaged it to Myron, and Myron asked for the guy's phone number. And I don't know what they were going to try to do with it, if they were going to try to – I don't know what they did with it. I lost touch after that, but it was crazy.
There have been cases where they've dispatched just for humane reasons. I mean, when they get that bad, it's hard to see them suffer like that. There are, I think it's in Wisconsin where they kind of have a scale for how bad the individual is. And if it meets a certain requirement, they're actually treating with ivermectin. Anecdotally, they've had experience with that actually working. We have treated a few bears. We have treated a few bears that we've captured in our study, and it has worked.
Oh, really?
One bear did get it again the next summer.
But one shot of ivermectin
did the trick. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so so that's another thing that we're looking into now. We've started putting some collars on some of those mangy individuals without treatment to see, can they recover from it without treatment?
Yeah.
Or is treatment something that we need to look into from a long-term management standpoint?
Would there be any danger in eating a bear that had some bit of mange?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean,
it would just be
because it's all in the skin. It's not inside them. It's just, they actually burrow and live in their skin. That's why they get that. It's real, crusty and thick skin, because those mites are actually living inside the skin. So once you've skinned out that bear, everything underneath, I would imagine, should be just fine.
It just might be compromised in terms of health. I mean, not in a disease.
Well, they're going to be thin.
It might be thinner or leaner or something.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because somebody had asked us about that, and I didn't know. I'd seen it. I've seen a bear with mange up in the wilderness of Saskatchewan one time, but that's the only bear in the wild that I've ever seen that had it. So, I mean, I guess it's common in a sense, but just becoming more common, sounds like.
And in a word to the wise, humans can get bear mange, I know from experience. We worked... one of the females that we worked up, I actually ended up getting mites on my stomach.
No way.
And the good news, well, at least what I read, was that they could bite me, but it would basically, it's like a chigger bite. They're not living on me. You know, they couldn't complete a life cycle or anything.
You're a mammal with
Well, so I don't know. And again, this is all part of what they're learning about the mites. And they used to think that it was species specific. And now I think they found that it's not necessarily. So maybe coyotes can get the same that the bears do and that kind of thing. Those particular mites didn't get a chance to live on me because I might have dipped myself with dog dip before driving
home. Good call.
Wow. Because I didn't want to take any chances.
I don't want this reputation to follow you, but you're the one that brought it up. You are the only person I know that's had mange.
It's all in the name of the job.
That is a badge of honor in our book.
I am not shy about it.
Wow.
And I'd do it again if I had to.
Yeah, you know, that I actually was thinking that and I didn't say it. I mean, just like, yeah, can you get it?
Yeah, so now we actually, so we carry in our kits, we've got Tyvek suits, and then to kill the mites on our gear, we found that one of the things that the UGA folks found was that if you freezed at below a certain level for a certain amount of time, you'd kill all of them.
The freeze
and
kills
so
the mites.
Every bit of our gear, if we actually handle any mangy bears or even suspect that we're dealing with one that might have mange, then we have all of these protocols so that we're not sharing with other bears. So they carry a couple of kits with them just to be sure that in case you have more than one capture a day, you're not having to use the same weigh net on both bears, things like that.
Yeah, and spread.
Because
it.
We certainly don't want to take any chances of us being the cause of the spread either.
Yeah.
So it's changed the face of our research just a little bit, not only in the fact that we're trying to look into this issue, but also how we function so that we don't contribute to the spread.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as our bears don't start getting COVID, we'll be good.
Well, I will tell you this, that we're already making plans and discussions at this point. You know, we generally, during our den work, we usually have groups of folks that go out with us, landowners, different things like that. And because we don't know if the bears can get it from us or not, we're already starting to think about how to manage our den season this next year.
There's a lot of people, a lot of these are kind of so like people.
It's
are
an
going
educational
on
situation. So we have a lot of people and we obviously already know that we are not going to be able to or willing to handle it the same way that we've done in the past.
Even as
cautious as we always are, that we're having as little impact as possible on the bears to begin with COVID, we're definitely concerned and have started some plans to see how we're going to manage that.
Yeah. That's
for this next year. Even over the summer, we had to live and work under different conditions because of the university regulations. And we took extra precautions even with the bears we were dealing with. If we had any scares or anything, that if we thought somebody had potentially been exposed, then we tried to keep them, you know, with masks and gloves and things too. So it goes beyond just the human world.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to think that we're trying to protect these animals from COVID. I heard a story of a guy that I know that had a bat like nesting in his like porch. And he knew the wildlife guy, and I'm not even going to name the state, and he texted a picture to his wildlife buddy about this bat and what he should do. This is right in the heat of COVID. And the guy was like, just make sure you don't. I mean, essentially he said, don't give the bat your COVID.
Yeah.
He wasn't worried about the bat having COVID, give it to him. He was like, if you have COVID, we don't want the bat to get COVID. Anyway, that is totally rabbit trail. Well, Sarah, truly a pleasure talking with you. For real. I respect what you're doing and just appreciate your knowledge and expertise over here in Oklahoma. And I mean, no doubt you've handled more bears than anybody over here, I would say. I don't have a Oklahoma bear handling meter, but if I did, I think you would probably have.
Jeff Ford might rival me on that
one. Okay, well,
he might, but
You're right.
But
Jeff,
I've been definitely extremely fortunate to get to do what I've done here.
Yeah, for sure.
And I appreciate you having me. I could talk bears all day long. So.
Well, and every time I do a podcast with somebody that's really an expert, I always, as soon as we shut this thing off, I'm going to go, dadgum, why didn't I ask her about that? We'll find a reason to do this again.
Do a follow-up.
Yeah. So really appreciate it. But keep the wild places wild, because that's where the bears live.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.